This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. Today I'm inaugurating a new series of interviews. These are about the history of publishing as opposed to the future of publishing. I'm more interested in what a number of really key publishers have done over the last few years. And I have the great pleasure of talking to John Martin, the founder and for a long time operator of Black Sparrow Press. Hi, John. How are you?
Well, I'm very good, thank you.
Now, Black Sparrow, I think, you know, it's you might say Black Sparrow needs no introduction, but let's assume that not everyone who's listening will know Black Sparrow. You know, you started in 1966, if I have that correct.
Yes.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the genesis. I mean, not only what got you to begin to publish, but also what you had been doing up until that point as a kind of background to becoming a publisher.
Well, I, as a boy, I got into reading very early. And I read all the young adult material and began to move into more literary books when I was about 16 or 17. And then I began to run across authors like Paul Bowles, The Sheltering Sky, which was published in the late 40s. And that turned me into a serious reader, where I had no interest at all in anything that I didn't consider was serious literature. And then I became a book collector. And in those days, before the paperback revolution, if you wanted to read Faulkner's Sanctuary, for instance, the only book available, the only edition available, was the first edition. And so in a haphazard and kind of unconscious way, I ended up with a library of first editions, which at that time were selling for $2 and $3. In fact, the most valuable book I ever bought was the first issue of the first edition of Lawrence's first book called The White Peacock, which is now about a $15,000 book. It cost me $1.50 at Acres of Books.
Now,
so I continued reading, and one day in my early 30s, and I had built up a big collection, I ran across Bukowski's work in Mimeo magazine, so I was immediately entranced. And while I didn't make the connection at the time, I made arrangements to sell my collection of first editions to UC Santa Barbara. And then suddenly I had, for the first time in my life, money in my hand and the beginning of a connection with an important author. And from there, I just went with the flow.
Well, how did you make the connection with Bukowski? Did you just seek him out?
First, of course, I read his stuff. He was being widely published in the early 60s and
right.
late 50s in underground Mimeos and Multilith and other sort of non-professional types of printing. And I liked those, that kind of periodical. And there were bookstores in L.A. that would carry them. And I would just go in, see what was new. These books only cost a quarter, 50 cents, sometimes a dollar. And I ran across Bukowski's work, and it was like turning a light on in a dark room. And I thought, gee, he lives in Los Angeles. I can't believe it. And I looked in the phone book, and there he was. And I called him, I guess principally to tell him how great he was. And we struck up a conversation, and I decided that I was going to publish him. I had the example of all this underground stuff being published. So I thought, okay, I'll be an underground publisher.
So your model essentially for publishing was the kind of sub rosa publishing scene, late 50s, early 60s. There were a lot of really small, people call them fugitive publishers. You know, they're kind of mostly
Absolutely.
Done by
and
writers.
They weren't really publishers. They weren't publishers, they were producers.
Right.
They would sit down and do 100 copies on a mimeograph machine in their living room.
Right. And so, but that was essentially, you weren't looking at other models. Those were the
publishers. One other model. I had one other model that stayed with me all my life, and that was New Directions.
Right.
And it got to the point before any of this happened that any time I went into a bookstore and saw a New Directions book on the shelf, I would buy it because I knew I would like it. And I wanted to, later on, that became a model for me. I wanted the people to buy a Black Sparrow book, whether they've heard of the author or not, because Black Sparrow had published it.
Right, and then that kind of gets into this whole kind of question about how you came upon, you created a very particular style for your books. You know, I remember them in those days.
They you mean were format or content?
Let's say format first. That the books were all pretty much the same size. There was a continuity of design style. The covers were type only, and they were very well designed. The typography was really high quality. I think, again, this is my question. You printed, as I recall, letterpress covers, and maybe you were doing letterpress for the first few books.
We did letterpress for several years.
Yeah.
And my wife, Barbara Martin, was the designer, and she did all the covers and title pages, and the thing sort of evolved. As it went along, we used more color. We used illustrative covers. You know, the thing grew in a very organic way as we went along. And then I didn't care for the 5x8 paperback size. And so I started to publish books that were 6x9, and immediately my sales reps, and I had sales representation at that time, this would have been very late 60s or maybe very early 70s, came running to me and said, "No, you'll kill your publishing company. The racks aren't built for 6x9. And so, being very ignorant and also egotistical, I said, "Well, let them build new racks." And now, of course, every quality paperback is 6x9.
It's true, though. Your books were an unusual size. They stood out. I think there were in some stores it was problematical because your books were produced. I remember this. You also used uncoated cover stock. You had what
yes.
we would call soft paper, regular paper without a coating. And I think
Absolutely.
A lot of bookstores at that time were really worried about the books becoming dirty and damaged, in the store because they were, they would attract, when people handled them, they would pick up fingerprints and stuff like that. But I think your books stood out in stores and I think made an impression on readers, which, today we would say you created a brand in part by the physical nature of the books, the formatting, the paper, the consistency of design, elements that repeated over books. And then, of course, the other component of the brand is the content, where you began to establish a kind of turf, if you will, in publishing. And so maybe
then one author always leads to another. And right after I actually started out just doing some broadsides by Bukowski. And then I did the first what you would call a book with a square spine that I did. It was by Ron Lowenson, who was a poet in San Francisco. And then I did Robert Kelly and Diane Lukoski. And all of these people had friends. And the minute, for instance, Jerome Rothenberg, who was a friend of Dan Lukoski's, saw that there was somebody publishing Lukoski, I would receive a manuscript from those people. None of them had publishers. Certainly not publishers who were bringing out books on a regular basis. Toward the end of the 60s, I'd have to go look in the bibliography to see. I had no help except Barbara, who was doing the covers only. And in one year, I published 28 or 29 books all by myself. I did the editing. I oversaw the printing. I did the shipping. I did the billing. I did the collecting. It was a one-man band.
Well, and it obviously, when you're beginning, that's one of the keys is that you do all the work yourself.
Yeah, but 28 books in one year.
That's a lot of
That's
books.
more than one every 2 weeks.
Right. And how and
But
who it, at in the first few years, where were your books being printed?
Let's see. Well, I'm going to simplify that because it's a little confusing. But the first printer was Noah Young in Santa Barbara, who later became a publisher and
Right.
turned his shop over to Graham McIntosh. And then I continued doing business with Graham until the end.
And they were printing that's when it was letterpress printing.
Up till about 19, up until about 1972, I think that was the year that we published a book of short stories by Bukowski called South of No North. And I had underprinted the first printing, and I could see we were going to need more copies within a few weeks. And I went down to the shop, and in an offhand way, I said, let's do another 1,000. And I mean, the look of horror on everybody's face, and he took me over and showed me how much metal type and how many drawers that one book took, and what a huge job it was to pull all that type out again, lock it up in the press and print more copies. And that's when I decided we would do the covers and the title pages, both in color and letterpress, but that the rest of the book would be done offset with a big printer in the East.
And that's when you started using Edwards Brothers
I
in
started
our
using Hedges Brothers.
and you used Edwards Brothers then for the rest of the life of the
For
press?
the rest of time, yes.
That was like 35 years or 30 years.
Yeah.
So just to go back, and then this is another thing about the physical production. I don't know how soon in the press you started doing the limited editions to go along with the trade run, but
Right
it.
from day one, there was always a small special edition of some kind. Because that made the difference between making a little money on a book or losing a little money on a book. I mean, if I did 250 copies of a slim paperback for $2 or $3 at the most, and then I did 50 copies hardcover for $10 or $15, that was my profit. And I sold those 50, and later 100, and later 200, and later 300, and finally 750. I would sell those signed copies out first, and that would be the first return on the book, and then the paperback would sell more slowly.
Did you sell most of the hardcover limited editions to libraries, or did they go to collectors, or was it a kind of mixture?
It was a mixture. I had about 100 or 125 libraries that took everything we published. And they would either take a cloth or a signed edition or just a cloth trade edition, because the trade editions came along a little later when I just didn't have enough cloth signed editions to meet the demand. And then I could reprint the cloth trades. So I had those 125, roughly, those libraries, plus maybe another 25 or 50 institutions that bought. And then I had certain bookstores that had big collector trades, like Gotham Book Mart in New York and Phoenix Bookshop in New York. And then there were specialized dealers like Margaret Cohen of the House of Books that had collectors. And Margaret used to take like 10 hardcovers of everything I did. So, I mean, that was a good collector's market. And then over time, some of those collectors came to me and we would sell them directly.
So you did sell directly to individuals at some point.
Especially toward the end, yes, and especially with Bukowski.
Right. And of course, I mean, obviously Bukowski became I guess the bestseller for you, I mean, by
He was the
far.
big
Yeah.
butter and egg man, yes.
Right. So, and was pretty loyal to you and you to him. Did you develop a pretty close friendship with Bukowski over the years that you were his publisher?
We never, so far as I recall, we never had an argument. And Bukowski, he could get ornery. And if he'd been drinking, I mean, I've heard about him lashing out at people and even getting into fights. But I never saw that side of him. He was always very respectful about his best behavior, because every 2 weeks, out of nowhere, he would get a check from me. And it was, you know, it was like an annuity. He could count on it. He knew it was going to be there. And he never did anything that might have disturbed that relationship. I'm not saying it was all money. He also knew that the primary thrust of the press, I mean, I took care of all my authors, and I loved all my authors, but let's face it, Bukowski was number one, and he knew that. And to be number one with Black Sparrow and to have a certain economic floor that only got larger as time went on. I mean, I started out, it was only $100 a month, which I promised to pay him for life, whether Black Sparrow succeeded or not. Very, not foolish, but risky, we'll say. And by the end, I was thinking, what was I, sending him $10,000 every 2 weeks.
That's a lot of money for a poet.
That's a lot of money for a poet. I always maintain that without teaching and without giving readings, like, say, Allen Ginsberg, Bukowski made more royalties than any serious poet ever.
That's an amazing thing. And I guess, you know, you have to take some credit for that, because I don't think he would have been able to do that without you behind him at that early stage. I don't think it would have happened that way.
And you know what really makes an author take off? A book a year. But most authors can't write a book a year. And most publishers aren't willing to publish a book a year. But
although,
I don't think a year ever went by without my publishing a Bukowski book.
Well, he was a pretty prolific guy.
Yeah. I mean, and when he died, he left me, you know, 1,000 poems unpublished, which over a period of 7 years, I edited, and they were published by Echo Press in 7 books.
Oh, so that was actually after you sold the press to Echo.
It was after I sold the press.
Right. Well, let's go back to the earlier years, because I think that, you know, I want to kind of get a feel, or get you talk a little bit about what it was like then, you know, let's say in the 70s, which was, you know, in a certain way, a period of many bookstores, certainly compared to later years. Mostly, you know, they would be independent small bookstores spread out all over America, all over the world, for that matter.
At one time, we had about 1,100 independent bookstores, this is not the chains, buying from us every month, maybe every 2 months, but it was a constant stream of small orders. And if one did go belly up, it didn't matter. It's not like all your eggs were in one basket. And by the time we quit, that 1,100 had shrunk to less than 50. And we were doing 80 or 85% of our business with 3 large chains. And that's one reason I sold. First of all, they came to me with an offer. I wasn't thinking of it. But I could see that sooner or later, I was the only publisher that I know of in America who was selling non-returnable. And I could see that Borders and Barnes & Noble and Ingram, those were the 3 big buyers of Black Sparrow books at the end. Sooner or later, they were going to say, okay, Martin, we're going to start returns. And that would have killed me.
Well, yeah, I think for you, it would have destroyed your business, because you had started out, you know, you had the benefit of non-returnability, which is an incredible blessing for a publisher.
Right.
And to have to take that on at the time when, you know, the returns rate, and this is sort of getting into the weeds of what the publishing business is like, but at the time that of 2002, when you sold your business, that's the period of the kind of the independents were mostly in decline, and the large, as you described them, the large retailers, you know, really dominated and still do, and the returns rate did nothing but go up.
Returns rates were, when I sold, were about 50% for the rest of the book trade. Now, if we had gotten 50% of our books back every year, I mean, that just would not have worked financially. So, anyway, I saw all kinds of, but you don't go from 1,100 to 50 bookstores and not realize that there's something in decline here. And I would have hung on as long as possible. But when HarperCollins came along, and what they really wanted, they didn't want Black Sparrow. They wanted the publication rights to Paul Bowles, Charles Bukowski, and John Fonte. And that's what I sold them.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this, that kind of extension of your publishing, because, you know, when you started, it was Bukowski and probably a bunch of poets who are now pretty well known, but at that time were not, certainly not famous, and probably were not selling, you know, multiple thousands of copies each. But, you know, over time you broadened your list considerably. And
well, have you ever, let me just interject this.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard about dying and going to heaven? Well, starting a publishing company in 1966 was the equivalent of dying and going to heaven. I mean, you were in the trade at that time. I mean, we sold every book we published. It didn't matter whether people heard them or not. I could publish a completely unknown writer like Cheryl Jaffe, and people would buy it and read it the way I used to buy and read New Directions books. And all of a sudden, Cheryl Jaffe had a following.
Right, and you published a lot of people who were not well known then, like Lucia Berlin and
Lucia's a wonderful writer. Yeah,
Andre Kudrescu, you were publishing before he became as famous as
right.
he is today.
Anyway, and then also I had people like Robert Creeley, and Robert Duncan before they really anchored up with. Creeley with Scribner's and Duncan with New Directions. I published their books. I published a number of small books by Creeley that did very well.
Well, how did you come to publish Paul Bowles?
Well, I think I mentioned at the very beginning of this conversation that I remember as one of the first real works of literature that I read that made me realize that there were two kinds of writing. Writing that's worth reading and writing that's not worth reading. And, you know, and I'm very autocratic about that. I mean, unnecessarily so and wrongfully so. But I have a hierarchy in writing, and if you're not part of that A list, forget it. I don't want anything to do with you. But Paul Bowles, I read, and the other writer who turned me on to a life on the page is Christopher Isherwood, the Berlin stories. I don't know how long it's been since you read those, but they're fantastic. And I realized there was a way of writing that transcended plot, that transcended form, and it's there very much so in Bukowski, that you get so engaged that you live what you're reading while you read it. You live it. Fitzgerald had that quality. Theodore Dreiser had that quality. Sherwood Anderson had that quality. D.H. Lawrence had that quality. And those are the writers I read before I got into modern lit. To this day, D.H. Lawrence is still my favorite writer of all time.
No, I think your
Henry Miller had it.
Yeah, I think your reading ethos is reflected in your publishing ethos. That's certainly true. I guess what I wanted or was trying to ask was, how did you find Paul Bowles? Did you seek him out? Did he come to you? How did that happen?
You know, you can't plan life. You can't plan who your new friend is going to be next week or who your poet is going to be next week. It's organic. And people are drawn to you and you're drawn to them. You've been to a big party and certain people you meet for the first time and there's a spark and you enjoy talking to them. Well, there were lots of authors out there that I would love to have published, but I could never get near them. I'd love to have published Saul Bellow. I'd love to have published Bernard Malamud. You know, I would love to publish John Ashbery, I couldn't get to these people. They were far beyond, you know, my, the scope of Black Sparrow Publishing. So I got the best of what I could. And I don't think I ever published a book that I looked back and said to myself, gee, why did I publish that?
Well, so let me see. If you think about then kind of, I guess it sort of grew organically, but what would you say is the, I don't know, I guess your the discovery, aside from Bukowski, which is fairly
right.
obvious, who else do you feel that you published and kind of gave the recognition to that gave them the start and that, you know, kept them, brought them to the attention of a reading public? And
so many. I mean, Robert Kelly, you know, Diane Wachowski, I mean, Clayton Asherman, he was my, what did they say about St. Paul? He had a thorn in the flesh. Never went away. Well, Clayton was my thorn in the flesh, but I published like 20 or 30 or even 40 books by him. You mentioned Lucia Berlin. I published an unknown poet named Nancy Boutelier, who is a wonderful poet. I published David Bromwich early on. I mean, these people, poets sort of hang out in cliques or groups. And I publish one person in a clique, and then that person would say, hey, you know, so-and-so was really good, too. Why don't you look at a manuscript by him, which I would do. Publish James Broughton. I'm looking at a...
Oh, you published also, you published in the Imagists, you published George Oppen, and I think
and Charles Reznikoff, one of my favorite poets of all time is Charles Reznikoff.
Right, Reznikoff is
phenomenal. Published Laura Chester and Tom Clark.
Yep.
Ed Dorn, Larry Eigner. I published the complete William Everson in three volumes. And then, you know, later on when I ran... Bukowski turned me on to John Fante. I brought out all of Fante's books. I became personally interested in Wyndham Lewis. I spent $500,000 bringing Wyndham Lewis back into print.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you about Wyndham Lewis. I wanted to know what spurred your interest in that, because he's sort of, you know, kind of a, I would, you know, you don't want to say obscure, but he certainly is not a commonly read writer anymore.
Well, he is now.
Yeah, you think so?
Sure. I published 30 Wyndham Lewis books. I published Thaisa Frank, who's not a... I published Paul Goodman, who's been around forever.
Yeah.
Of course, Lynn Lifshin, you know. I published Charles Olson's correspondence with Creeley in 10 volumes.
I know, that was an amazing piece of work.
I published Eileen Miles and Edward Roditi, a surrealist, and Ed Sanders. I talked to Ed the other day, and he thanked me. He says, you brought me back from the dead. In the 90s, I had nothing but readings and appearances at universities, thanks to you. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. I published John Sanford, who was the other thorn in my side, who's a wonderful writer. I published Aram Saroyan, James Schuyler, Jack Spicer.
Tell me a little bit about Jack Spicer. Somebody has just reprinted one of his books, and I'm... How did you come to publish Jack Spicer? Because I think he...
Well, you couldn't publish Duncan and Creeley and Olson and all those people without getting deep into Spicer's work. He's a really fantastic poet, a very important poet.
Yeah, he was great.
Actually. I did his collected books.
Yeah, no, the range of your publishing is pretty amazing.
When you asked me why I published Wyndham Lewis... First of all, because he's the greatest British draftsman of the 20th century, I mean, and a great painter. And it interested me that someone who could paint and be that important would write, also write novels. And I remember back in the 50s, I read Self-Condemned. That is a great book. I mean, I had my little copy of that in my hand for almost my whole life. And when there, what I was always looking for was someone I really believed in and loved to read. I mean, if I didn't like to read him, I didn't want to publish him. And I loved to read Wyndham Lewis, and he had published so many books, and there he was for the asking.
So
all
did
I had to
you,
do, I, would, I did, mean, just, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you, did you have to negotiate with the estate to get his rights?
They begged me, and they said, oh, fine, wonderful, go ahead. And they only wanted a very small royalty. When they wanted to get the books back into print, and then I used all of Lewis's artworks on every cover. And
yeah,
it put Lewis back on the map.
I do remember those. Those are his. He, you know, he comes from that period of, you know,
of vorticism and and the Marionetti, you know, Italian futurism. That kind of jagged. Anyway, it was a great movement in England, the vorticist movement in art. I mean, if you want to buy a vorticist painting, think $500,000 to $1 million.
That's cheaper to buy
more.
A vorticist book.
So anyway, see, I had read so widely as a teenager. I mean, I would put down the Henry Miller book and pick up a Theodore Dreiser, and put down a Dreiser and pick up Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson, and put down Winesburg, Ohio and pick up Tender is the Night by Fitzgerald, and put that down and pick up Hemingway's stories. And it gets to the point when you read stuff like that, anything lesser comes off, you know, as unworthy. I mean, people used to ask me, how do you pick a manuscript? How do you know it's good or bad? And I said, well, if you had a symphony orchestra and somebody said, I want to be your first violinist, and you handed him a violin and gave him a piece to play, how long would it take you to tell whether you wanted him in your orchestra? I mean, as you know yourself, I mean, let's be honest about it. I've got well over 1,000 manuscripts a year, unsolicited, and in the, let's see, how long was I in business? About over 30 years. So that's maybe I got 30,000 unsolicited manuscripts in the history of Black Sparrow. Do you know how many I published?
Oh, I'm going to guess none.
All right. No, four. I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, he was cruel, but what Truman Capote said, he said they aren't writers, they're typists. And there's some truth to that.
Well, that's true.
I mean, it's just today I got a letter from a guy in prison that I send books to. I've been doing it for 10 or 12 or 15 years. Everything I send him I consider great literature. And I just sent him a book that I read when I was 16 and made me want to be a writer. And I got a letter from him to say, oh, I'm into this book. It makes me want to write. And, of course, who is it? It's Thomas Wolfe. A great place for a young guy to start reading. Where you get all that bombast and language and humor and dread. I mean, he's just a perfect place for someone who's going to end up a serious reader to start.
Well, did you feel like when you were publishing that you were contributing to that, you know, that kind of the same milieu? You wanted people to read those books.
Yeah, sure, I did. And I got mad when they didn't. If I get with Lucia Berlin, I would take it personally. If somebody said to me, gee, I read that book by Lucia Berlin, I thought it was terrible. I mean, they might just as well insult my sister. I mean, I know how good Lucia is.
Well, you know, when you're a publisher, you take on, I mean, you do take on this kind of commitment
parental,
to the work.
Parental. Parental.
Yeah. Well, and did you, all right, so over the course, when you were first starting, was this a full-time job for you?
No, God, no. I mean, I published Bukowski in 66, and I quit my everyday job in 69. That's 4 years. I would go to work at 7:30 in the morning, where I managed a rather large company, and I was the last one to leave at 6 o'clock, lock the door, go home, have dinner, go to my Black Sparrow office and work till 1 or 2 in the morning. And I did that for 4 years. And then it was sun up to sun down on Saturdays and Sundays. That's when I did all my shipping.
One of the things I remember is that, and maybe you stopped doing this near the end, but you used to put stamps on all of your boxes.
You know what? I do have a postage meter now, but we put stamps on packages, I think, till about the year 2000.
Was that just...
35 years. I just liked it. It was personal.
Yeah, no, I think people receiving your boxes noticed that. I certainly did. That you didn't use postage labels, you put stamps on them. I thought that was really, it was definitely unusual. For, you know, for a business of your size, even at that
time.
And
the label was always straight, too.
Yeah.
I was a great packer. Well, in fact, when I stopped packing, right away I began to hear from people, we got your package, nothing was damaged, but it certainly wasn't up to your usual standards. I had to step in and shape up my packer.
Right. Well, you know, it's hard when you start a business and you do all of the jobs. And
it's hard to let go of any of them.
Exactly. And then, you know, no one can ever do it as well as you did.
Well, that's not true, but you like to think so.
Right. That's what I mean.
As time went along, I had some wonderful employees who just gave their heart and soul to what they were doing. And my last assistant, Michelle Phil, she was just superb, such a wonderful person. And before her, a girl named Julie Voss was with me for quite a few years. And she really got into it. She wrote the introduction to a book I published, and she was quite literary, but she was, her job was to answer mail and generate orders for the packer. So she was stuck at that level, but she reached out into other areas.
Well, when you started, you were in L.A., and what year did you leave Los Angeles and move to Santa Rosa? I'm sorry?
I was in L.A. from as a Black Sparrow, 66 to 75, and then I left Santa Barbara for Santa Rosa in 86. So it's about 10 years, and then I've been 25 or 6 years here.
So were the moves made just to get to places which were less expensive, or was it...
Partially, but also I had bought a house in Santa Barbara, and even though it sounds like pennies in today's real estate market, I paid $100,000 for it, and I sold it for $500,000. And that way I could come up here to be closer to our daughter, who was working in San Francisco, who I could pay cash for a house. So I haven't had a mortgage for 25 years. And I needed to keep my own expenses down in order to pay the people a salary I wanted to pay them. Now, again, this is, you have to remember, is 10 years ago in a small town, not quite rural, but close to it. But my packer stayed with me, got a raise every year. And at the end, to pack my books, instead of making $10 or $12 an hour, I was paying them $50,000 a year. Because I could afford to.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable.
And then my assistant was making considerably more when she wasn't working for $15 or $18 an hour. I was paying her like $65 or something like that. My bookkeeper came back one day, all smiles. I said, "What's going on?" She said, "I was just talking to the president at our Bank of America." And I said, "Oh, that's nice." She said, "I make more than he does." And all my employees will end up buying houses here, which I never could have done if I had paid the going rate. They think that we had low expenses, and we're selling books all over the world. I wasn't worried about selling books in Santa Rosa. I was worried about selling books in Chicago and New York.
Well, I think that Black Sparrow might stand as the most successful independent or literary press that anybody has ever seen. I'm not sure that.
Self-generated. It's not as successful as New Directions, but Jim told me on more than one occasion that in the early years he would go get $200,000 from an aunt who loved him, a rich aunt, and put it into the press. But we generated all of our own money. So you're correct. Without, you know, living on grants or without having personal money, I mean, I had no money when I started. I was making $1,000 a month back in 66. And I had a wife and a child. And I was giving Bukowski 100 of it.
Well, fortunately, at that time, it was less expensive to print books. Shipping costs were lower.
Oh,
You know,
I
it's a
could print a, I could pu print a book for $600.
Right.
And
Well,
when
but
I,
of course, book
at
prices
the
were
end,
lower,
print a book would cost me 4,000.
which is still not bad.
No,
And
or five, sometimes five.
book prices were so low in the 60s compared to what they are today. Although, in some ways, you know, the inflation in book prices is much less than it is in other areas. But when you first started publishing, I think what I remember was that your books, you know, the kind of average Bukowski book was probably $4,
Right.
which seemed like a lot then because you could buy like a regular, you know, trade paper, or not trade, but a, you know, a small book of poetry for a dollar and a quarter or something. And
A mass market, yeah.
yeah.
But then, you know, there wasn't that much good literature in mass market. I mean, the occasional Ginsberg or something like that, or Kerouac.
And you were
But I
using.
remember when I published Paul Bowles' collected stories. It's like, I don't know, 400 pages long, beautiful letterpress cover in five or six colors. And Barbara really outdid us now. And it was $4. You know, that means that I get back on the average, you know, averaging out bookstores and wholesalers, I'm getting back $2. And then I'm paying Paul Bowles 40 cents. That's $1.60. The damn book is costing me $1.30 or $1.40. I'm making 20 cents a book. But I have 300 hardcovers signed. That's 25 or 30 bucks. And, you know, that gets me past the expense of the first printing.
Right.
And then, you know, like for instance, post office. When I by the time I got to the 50th printing, it was costing me a dollar half, $1.60 a piece, and the prices were up then to about like I used to get like $10 for that book.
Right. No, I think that clearly the economics of your initial economics were that you would make money on those limited editions, you
Right.
know, and that kind of covered that made it possible. And then later, I think with the books like, you know, with the Bukowski books, then you were kind of in the place where a big publisher is. Once you get to a certain volume, then you really make money on an average trade
Bukowski's
book.
book, Post Office, was published in 71. So I'm out of business in 2002, so that's 30 years. It sold between 5 and 10,000 copies a year for 30 years.
Yeah, that's a lot of books.
It's like a little money tree.
Right.
That's why I can afford to send those big checks to him. In fact, I did it out of fear. If I had waited till the end of the year and owed him 150,000, it never would have been there.
No, that I think that was very smart of you because most publishers, in
Paid him
fact,
every month and gave him a sales report. Not just send a check, I sent a sales report, what we'd sold that month. And I, you know, at the end, I was keeping track of 35 books.
well, how was the bookkeeping on that? That must have been pretty
Oh,
intense.
I did it all myself in pencil. Don't even talk, it's horrible.
Wow. And did your was your bookkeeping, I mean the check
We
writing
didn't
that?
have computers. I mean,
Right.
I didn't ever use a computer until after I'd sold this business.
So it was all manual.
It was all manual. We had we generated our computer, our invoices via computer.
But the
Not
bookkeeping
even,
itself was all manual.
all manual on cards, pen and ink.
And then, so transferring those numbers, the sales numbers had to be then transferred manually.
Oh, that was, I did it a much easier way. I would write down how many books we had in inventory, how many books we, if we reprinted, we printed, and how many books were in inventory at the end. And I'd take royalty on that.
That's very clever. So, but that's because you were non-return selling non-returnable
Only
meant,
non-returnable,
right?
and if there was something that went wrong, I might lop off $100 or $50 or something I could justify.
Well, you could have like a shipment going out to somebody and then it doesn't get to where it's going and it comes back to you after the royalty period or something, but then it would true up in the next one.
Yes, it would. It
Yeah,
always
that's.
kept itself square. And
Yeah.
then every author could have as many books of their own without limit as they wanted.
That's an amazing deal.
And I had a couple of authors that most did not abuse that. They would take 20 or 30 copies in a year. I had authors that said, please send me 75 copies. I'm getting a reading somewhere and I know I'll sell them. I'd send them to 75.
Well, for them, that, any poets in particular, selling their own books, a little bit of money is actually pretty important.
Right.
They don't make too much money. So you were pretty progressive, I think, pretty author friendly in your.
And the reason we had such a broad base is, I mean, look at the difference between Paul Bowles and Gerard Malanga and Clayton Eshleman and Charles Bukowski and Wyndham Lewis. I mean, you have to throw a very wide net to catch those people, in one throw. But to me, they made perfect sense. And I published a lot. I republished a lot of Dreiser, who I just adore as a writer. I published his. I published, oh, I don't know, six, eight books by wonderful books by Dreiser. They all sold well. I got there was a little literary newspaper up in Seattle, and I sent out review copies of a book. Dreiser wrote his biography in two volumes, and trying to think which one it was. Newspaper Days was the second one, which was his life from about 1900 to about 1910, something like that. Anyway, I published this great big 500-page paperback of Dreiser, and I sent out review copies. And of course, it got mentioned in the New York Times and things like that, but nothing very, enlightening or ennobling. And all of a sudden, I got a review in this little Seattle giveaway about this guy saying this book was so big, and I saw it laying on the review table, and I really didn't know who Dreiser was. And I took it home, and it's the best book I have ever read. And I realized there are people like that out there.
Right. Well, but that's that's one of the things, the beauty of being, I always think of publishing as a kind of form of creativity. You're expressing your literary view and in the works that you publish, in the enthusiasm that you have for particular writers. So yours happens to be broad and kind of covers a lot of territory, but I think it defines your who you are as a person, and it's reflected in who you are as a publisher.
And it's all literature. It's not travel. It's not,
Well, that's true. That's important. You never
all literature.
strayed. You never strayed at all from being a purely literary publisher.
No. That's all I'm interested in. That's all I've ever read. I do read some biography once in a while, but an author that I really like and come out a new biography, I will read that. I still read constantly. It's
Do you
what,
ever
you know.
feel like you do you miss being a publisher?
Well, let me give you a metaphor. Let's say I really loved being a soldier, the camaraderie and the thrills and the danger and the status and everything. And I was a soldier for many years and I loved it. And then I retired and picked up the newspaper and read that my unit had just been overrun in a foreign country and everybody killed, would I say to myself, gee, I wish I had still was a soldier and could have been there?
You need not say anymore.
When I look at the scene, so to speak, of what publishing is now and the outlets for publishers, how can I want to be back into that grind? I mean, they're all dead. I'm sorry they died, but I don't want to be with them.
I think that's a good, that's probably the best possible answer. And it's actually a great ending point for our conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you about Black Sparrow. I'm sure there's some things that I forgot to ask or didn't think to ask, but
we'll talk again.
We will, and this was really great. So thanks for talking to me, John. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about publishing and books. I've been talking to John Martin, the founder and erstwhile proprietor of Black Sparrow Press.